Number of years ago, I was pastoring in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I was invited to speak to a class at the local Baptist seminary there and talk to them about Mennonites. Now, I happened to be meeting with my conference minister at the time, just shortly before I gave that presentation, and when I told him what I was going to do, he said, well, you probably shouldn't tell him what I often tell people. Of course, I asked, what do you tell people? He said, well, I tell them that Mennonites are a lot like Baptists, except we don't kill people. Not what I told him. Now, clearly, that is a gross overstatement, but it is a way that some of us might sort of think sometimes about who we are. We're people of peace, right? We don't historically participate in the military. We are conscientious objectors to war. We don't kill people. And if anybody knows things about Mennonites, once they get beyond the sort of confusion between us and the Amish, it does tend to be the fact that we are an historic peace church. Our commitment to peace is one that is perhaps especially important in these days when we see so much violence going on around us. We, of course, have seen it in the headlines, with ICE agents killing two protesters recently in Minnesota. And the reality is, these are only the two white protesters that have been killed recently. Seven people have been killed by ICE agents over the past year, or a little bit over, since the current administration took office. But most of them were black or Hispanic, including Silverio Villegas Gonzalez, who was killed just over 10 miles from where we are right now. That might add, the only other white person that was killed happened to be a transgender woman. But while these are what are grabbing the headlines these days, we need to emphasize that not all the violence is coming from ICE agents or their supporters. There's a growth of violence coming from the political left, from the killing of Charlie Kirk, to the murder of the CEO of United Healthcare, to the attempts on Donald Trump himself. There's been a clear rise in the past few years. In fact, PBS did a survey this past fall. And they found that right now, almost one-third of people in this country agree with the statement that Americans may have to resort to violence in order to get the country back on track. Now, that's striking because that's an increase. The number of people agreeing to that is increased by more than 50% in just 18 months. And if you break it down by party affiliation, you'll find that the number of Democrats that agree with that statement is now more than double what it was less than 2 years ago. Now is a time that we need to hear a message of peace. And to be clear that violence, deadly force, are not an appropriate response to political differences under any circumstances. Oftentimes, though, when we talk about our peace stance as Mennonites, we emphasize who we're not, or what we don't do. Okay, we're not Amish. We don't participate in the military. We don't kill people, right? Well, over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing from each one of the pastors. We'll each be doing a sermon similar to this on our peace stance, talking about what it is that we believe, the values that we hold to. Each of us has chosen words from Jesus that are foundational to our understanding of what Jesus is all about, and I think it's safe to say that we'll all be talking at least as much about what Jesus tells us to do as what he says not to do. And so we begin this morning in a place where a lot of Anabaptists will first turn to talk about our peace teachings, and that is Jesus' sermons on the Mount. And Jesus begins here with a quote from the Old Testament. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and that's something that you'll find repeated at least three times throughout the law of Moses. And in that context, this is a law that really is a limiting of violence. It says that if you strike me and knock out one of my teeth, I can only knock out one of yours in return. I can't knock out three. Now, if this were a principle that we applied more broadly, it really would limit violence. I mean, imagine a war where one side can only kill as many people as the other side, or destroy as many buildings as the other side. But Jesus is not content with just this limiting that the law gives. He wanted to go farther beyond that. And so he says, you have heard this, but I say you must not oppose those who want to hurt you. Or oftentimes this is translated, you must not resist the one who is evil. And a lot of people have understood this to mean that Jesus is saying, well, we should just passively submit to whatever people are doing to us. And that's led a lot of Christians to either condone some very unhealthy behavior, like putting up with spousal abuse, or to come up with all kinds of reasons why Jesus didn't really mean what he says here. But there is at least one other way of understanding this passage that I think comes a lot closer to what Jesus is talking about. And I'm indebted here to the late theologian Walter Wink, who was foundational in really developing this understanding. And he says that we really are misinterpreting what Jesus is saying here. Rather than saying, do not resist evil, a better translation would be, do not resist with evil. Do not resist by evil means. Jesus is not saying that we shouldn't resist, but he's talking about how we should resist. The means are important because actions that are intended to lead to justice need to be just in and of themselves. One cannot seek good ends by using evil means. And Jesus clarifies what he's talking about here by giving these three different examples, beginning with the one about turning the other cheek. Now it's noteworthy here that what Jesus actually says, if you strike somebody, or somebody strikes you on your right cheek, it sounds a little like an insignificant detail, but it's actually important here. Okay, so this is actually best to explain by demonstrating. So, okay, come on up. I promise I'm not going to hit you. Okay, go ahead and stand. What's your name?
Rich.
Rich. Nice to meet you. Okay, so, all right, Rich. So which is your, you know what, this works better actually if we went the other way. So here we go. Yeah, let's do that. There we go. Okay, so where's your right cheek? Right there. Okay. So if I were to strike you on your right cheek, how would I do that? And before you answer, keep in mind that in that context, culture, I would not use my left hand. The left hand's unclean. You don't use it for anything except for, well, cleaning yourself after you use the toilet. That's it. So if I were to strike you with my right hand on your right cheek, how would I do that?
Probably backhand.
Backhanded, exactly, like that. So this is a slap that's not intended to injure so much as it is to insult. Okay? I mean, it would hurt, but it's not going to seriously injure you. So this is the sort of strike, slap that it indicates a hierarchy, okay? It's how a master would strike a slave. It's how a superior officer would strike a soldier that is getting out of line, okay? Okay, so Jesus says, if somebody slaps you on your right cheek, turn to them your left. Okay, so go ahead and turn your left. There you go. Okay, now how would I strike you now if you're looking that way?
Probably a regular slap, I would think.
A regular slap, yeah, just like an open-handed slap.
Yeah.
Or, if I really wanted to do damage, I'd use a fist too, right? Okay? Either of those cases, though, that indicates more of an equal level. Okay? That's how you'd fight somebody if you really were getting into it one-on-one and were regarding each other not in a top-down manner, but more in an equal fashion. Okay? So that's what Jesus is talking about. So thanks a lot, Jim. Thanks, Rich. Thanks for helping out. All right. So, all right. Okay, so turning the other cheek then. Turning the other cheek. This is not a passive acceptance of getting slapped. It's an act that challenges the person who is doing the slapping to reconsider the person that is being slapped. It's a simple nonviolent act, turning the other cheek, forcing the aggressor to evaluate their actions and then to make a choice. Either stop the beating or regard that person as somebody who's equal. The same sort of thing is carried on in the other examples that Jesus gives here. I'm going to jump ahead a little to the last one. He talks about the going the second mile, right? Like turning the other cheek, going the second mile has become such a cliche these days. In fact, a lot of people probably couldn't tell you that that actually comes from something that Jesus said. But again, in context, it is a way of nonviolent resistance. Because Roman soldiers at the time could enlist a civilian to carry their pack, weighed 65, maybe 80 pounds, and they could force somebody to carry that pack, but there was a limit. They could only force them to carry it for 1 mile. If they tried to make somebody carry their pack for more than a mile, they would get in serious trouble. So imagine the situation again. Somebody is carrying the pack. You get to the end of the mile, and instead of putting it down, you say, "No, that's okay. I'll take it another mile." That's going to catch that soldier off guard. He's not going to know what to do. In fact, he's going to be worried about getting into trouble. Can you imagine trying to explain to a superior officer, "No, really, he wanted to carry my heavy pack another mile here in the desert"? Another way of nonviolent resistance. And again, we see it again with the other example that he talks about, giving one's coat as well as one's shirt. Different words that are used to translate it here. The important thing to know is that most poor people in Jesus' time would only have two garments. They'd have an inner one, sort of a tunic that they'd wear, and then there'd be a cloak that they'd put over them. And the law said that if somebody owed you money, you could take their cloak as a form of collateral. But you had to give it back at nighttime because that's what they used to cover up with. You could take it back again the next day. But that's all you could do, was hold on to that one cloak during the daytime. Again, Jesus is going beyond the law. He says, okay, if somebody sues you and they take your outer garment, go ahead and give them their inner garment as well. For the poor person, that means that they're now standing there stark naked in court. I won't demonstrate this one. But again, it catches the people off guard. And in our context, we would look at that person who's now disrobed in court and think, oh, what a shameful thing they've done. But in Jesus' culture, the shame would fall not on the person who is naked, but on the person who has caused them to be naked, on the creditor. And so in this instance, stripping is essentially a way of nonviolently demonstrating the moral corruption of this exploitive economic system that's taking advantage of poor. So in each of these three examples, Jesus is not calling on us to passively accept what happens to us or to other people. The way of peace that he teaches is one of nonviolent action. We sometimes refer to our beliefs as pacifism, which is a fine term, but we dare not confuse it with passivism because there's nothing passive about what Jesus is saying here. As he goes on to talk about loving one's enemies, that's a very active thing to do. And he demonstrates that throughout his life, this creative nonviolent action, forcing opposing parties in a conflict to reconsider their own actions. We see it when he rides a borrowed donkey instead of a war horse into Jerusalem. We see it when he goes into the temple and turns over the table of the money changers. He prohibits his disciples from violently resisting his arrest. He tells them, all who live by the sword shall die by the sword. He submits to an illegal trial, to a torturous death, but in the greatest victory ever, ultimately he bursts forth from the tomb on Easter morning, vanquishing death itself, not through military might, not through worldly power, but through the unsurpassed nonviolent power of divine love. Now, oftentimes we are told that this sort of loving one's enemy, it just is not practical. We cannot expect nation states to live by this, to turn the other cheek. It's just common sense. It's not going to work. But the truth is that modern social science has affirmed that creative nonviolent action can be very effective. There's a survey that was done about almost 20 years ago now. Two Harvard researchers who studied movements across around the world, all throughout the 20th century into the early 21st century, and they found that nonviolent movements were successful in creating change just over half the time, about 53%. Now, that means that almost half the time they fail, too. It's not that this is always going to work. But what was surprised the researchers themselves is that those movements that used violence were only successful 26% of the time, half as often. That means that nearly three-fourths of the time, violence fails to produce real change in spite of the incredible amount of time and money and energy that we put into our military and other violent, repressive forces. Now, don't get me wrong. Our primary reason for teaching and living lives of peace is because that's what Jesus teaches. That's how he lives. But we also can legitimately claim that nonviolence is a realistic and often more effective means of bringing about change. Erica Chenoweth was one of the authors of that, one of the researchers. Chenoweth did a TED Talk some years ago that's gotten more than 500,000 views by now. And in that, Chenoweth says, imagine what our world would look like if we allowed ourselves to develop some faith in nonviolent alternatives. What if our history courses emphasized the decade of mass civil disobedience that came before the Declaration of Independence rather than the war that came after? What if our social studies textbooks emphasized Gandhi and King in the first chapter rather than as an afterthought? What if every child left elementary school knowing more about the suffragist movement than they did about the Battle of Bunker Hill? What if it became common knowledge that when protest becomes too dangerous, there are many nonviolent techniques of dispersion that might keep movements safe and active? That world that Chenoweth is envisioning is the very world that Jesus taught, the one that he lived. And so I'd ask us, what if we put our faith in the same God that Jesus did? What if we sought God's guidance rather than the counsel of military advisors? What if we relied on the power of the Holy Spirit rather than on our own might? What if we turned the other cheek rather than striking back? What if we went the second mile instead of going just as far as we're asked? What if we put more emphasis on what we do than on what we don't do? What if we actively loved our enemies rather than hating them or just ignoring them? What if we, who claim to be followers of Jesus, actually believe that it is indeed thinkable to practice reconciling love amid the human conflicts in our world?